Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Life in today's tech-filled world is tough. Already, we have to worry about people stealing our credit card number when we buy a book on our Kindle at the coffee shop. Already, we lie awake nights afraid that our kid might see those pictures someone posted on Facebook from a party our freshman year. And now we find out that a disgruntled employee of our car dealer might just decide to cut off our ignition, disable our vehicle, and honk our car horn when we're hundreds of miles from home, just because he feels like it. It's a tough world out there, but that's why it's good that we have the Techsperts, our resident gurus of gadgets and all the latest in technology news about and around the internet. They join us every month here on Up to Date. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hello.
That's Dustin Jacobson, Chief Strategy Officer at Flat Square Technology Group, and Justin Parlett, who's a support system administrator at UMKC and their resident Apple expert. We're glad you guys are here. So really, someone got car hacked virtually?
Yeah, actually, there's a dealership down in Austin, Texas, and apparently they installed on their machines that they were leasing out a computerized system. All cars have computers in them now, and really we've been moving towards that for about the past 20 years or so. But they've installed a special piece of software on the computer on the car that allows the dealership to remotely cut off the engine of people who fall behind on their payments. Mm. And so a gentleman, a disgruntled former employee, got angry, hacked in, and turned off everybody's cars.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's been a really popular move, I suppose.
It seems to be a trend.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
We used to hear about going postal, and now everyone's going Hacksaw.
Now, I would say that this seems like obviously there are some serious privacy issues that should any old employee shouldn't be able to just get on and do this. Right?
Yeah, and that's where companies have used like GM's OnStar for several years. That really kind of started to take off in the mid 90s or so. So it's been out for a while. But there's a lot of questions here recently. Okay, now who really has access to that? There's been lawsuits in regards to like Netflix and other video companies where, that kind of stuff, what you rent is private. Well, if you think about that compared to everywhere that you drive during the day, that's a lot of information that can be used for good and evil purposes if so desired.
Yeah. I mean, is there any indication that the evil purposes are actually being used?
Well, I mean, in this instance, yes. But overall, this is not something that I think everyone needs to worry about right now. I mean, cars have had electronic control units or ECUs going back, to the 20s. It was originally kind of a response to a Clean Air Act requirements. So over the last 20 years.
The 2000s? Okay.
Yeah, over the last 20 years.
The 1920s, really, there were absolutely
cars. Well, let me have another sip of coffee. over the last 20 years, it's gotten to the point where instead of having one to two onboard computer systems that mainly just tracked emissions, now we're looking at 50 to 70 computer systems that are all independent of each other and then sometimes work in conjunction to control everything in your vehicle.
Right.
As anybody who's had to pay thousands of dollars in auto repair recently knows.
Right. Even the fender bender causes this
exactly.
major damage.
Exactly.
It is sort of one of those cases. A lot of these car dealerships, this is actually more of a predatory lending practice, right? They're setting these high payments that they know people can't make, knowing that they can disable the car and go out and reclaim it. So it's a use of technology for sort of insidious purposes.
Yeah, I mean, there are some real benefits to it. So if you look at the whole kind of financial justification of OnStar, if you are in an accident, I mean, there's some huge benefits to be able to communicate back from safety reasons, or if you get lost, you can ask for directions. So there are a lot of real tangible benefits to it. The challenge now is how do we balance that level of benefit with privacy and security? Because if all of a sudden someone can remotely unlock your car or remotely start it, then they can just as easily remotely turn it off. Now, in the case of theft, that's good. You want to be able to track the car, and there are obviously some privacy lawsuits going on about governments using that for good and evil purposes as well. But for this, the general consumer use is beneficial. People like it. They like to be able to do that. But all of a sudden, since your computer is in control of your whole car, brakes, engine, everything, for good and bad, now all of a sudden that can be used ultimately for evil if so desired.
Now, I think it's important to mention that it's not OnStar that was hacked to shut this off. This was a specific add-on that this particular dealership had placed into the car. So this isn't the case of hacking onto a system or creating new functionality in the vehicle that didn't previously exist. So we don't want to worry users in thinking you have OnStar, right. Your car can be hacked.
No, don't rip the OnStar out of
your car. Right, right. Yeah, that's not necessarily what we're saying. Right. But we're saying this is a proof of concept in that as we move forward with this technology, we have to consider how vulnerable that makes us to external attacks.
Yeah.
And the key is really – don't network your fleet together the way they have here. You know, we want to go Battlestar Galactica with it. Networking the fleet is a bad idea, I can geek out for just 1 second.
No, yeah, and there's also real benefits, too. Like, insurance companies now are starting to allow you to install certain chips or monitoring devices to obtain cost advantages.
Right, so they're monitoring how quickly you apply the brakes and how fast you go.
Right, speed. Mm-hmm. Right, so, you know, and because a lot of that, you know, when you look at, say, Google Maps or other mapping technologies, it'll give you an estimated time of arrival. Well, how are they figuring that out? Well, they know what the speed limit is in every roadway. They kind of estimate. So the same thing for the insurance companies. They know if you're driving 85 on a 65, you're probably a higher risk from an insurance standpoint.
So we're talking today about the car hacking incident, but about much more. We're talking about cloud computing, about the latest in internet speeds, and about advertising on Twitter and Facebook. We've got a lot on our agenda today with Justin Parlette and Dustin Jacobson, our tech experts. I want to actually catch up on something that's in the news this morning involving a breach of security at the FBI, right, Justin?
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. So there's this hacker group called AntiSec, and they've claimed that the FBI has compiled a database of 12 million UDIDs from Apple devices. Now, that's a unique identifying number that each device has. And that they're saying that what they've done is they've actually gone in, hacked into this FBI database, and they've released about 3 million of these numbers to the internet. Just as kind of a proof that they could, and also to demonstrate, hey, the FBI has this big database of Apple devices. Why?
So what could someone do with these numbers?
Well, theoretically, the UDID is most commonly used by cell phone carriers to determine, okay, this is the device that Brian owns, and so it can attach to our network. And we know no matter what IP address changes or what cell phone tower he's on, this UDID corresponds to the phone that he owns, so he can access it. It also is used for a lot of developers. So if you're enrolled in the Apple Developer Program, you can install beta versions of the software before they're available to the public, but Apple actually checks the UDID to make sure that you're a registered developer so that you can legally, as per the terms of agreement, run that beta software. So those are the two most common uses for a UDID number.
So I guess the question is, why would the FBI want all these UDID numbers?
Well, that's a good question. And one other thing that I'll add to that is that there's been changes, you know, over the last I think August is when Apple started cutting it off, because what this allows anybody to do is if you have that number, all of a sudden you can track individuals. And what I mean by that is you can track, oh, they went to Facebook, now they went to Twitter, now they went to CNN. Whereas if you're just browsing, you're pretty much anonymous. But all of a sudden, if you have a unique identifier, you can track individuals across the internet. So it's not just, you know, here's my username for CNN or whatever, but here's my whole internet pattern.
Not just where you are, but what you're looking at.
Right. And not only that, but everything about you, you know, what text messages, how many calls you make. There's tons of information that you can garner from that. So why the government would have that? Well, ultimately, it's because they're tracking individuals. The value of that unique number, if you think of it as like a Social Security number, you know, for medical insurance, everywhere I go, my Social Security number follows me there. And you can think about all the kind of privacy issues that opened up. And all of a sudden, you have a separate insurance, you know, number. You have a separate this number, and and everything is separate now because they realize the challenges in that.
I almost wonder if this isn't a new sort of identity theft risk. That if maybe it's not my Social Security number you need anymore, it's my UDI.
Well, I mean, it certainly does have some risk to it. And one reason why Apple decided that developers should no longer be able to access the UDID number, the change that Dustin alluded to just a few moments ago, was because they were afraid that some developers might be using that maliciously. So they've decided that developers can no longer access that. So individual apps, third-party apps that you install on your Apple device, no longer have access to that UDID, unlike the way it was for the last several years. So they understand that this is something that could potentially be used for evil, and so they're moving away from that.
We're talking with the Techsperts today on Up to Date here on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We've talked in the past about several different ways of connecting to the internet. And we know about the Ethernet cables. We know about Wi-Fi. And now today we're hearing about super Wi-Fi. Dustin, what is super Wi-Fi?
Well, you know, super Wi-Fi, and the idea behind it is to leverage parts of the spectrum that are not in use otherwise. So when you connect on Sprint, you know, there's one kind of technology and it has a certain range of frequencies that it uses versus GSM or others. So what this is even though it's called super Wi-Fi, really it isn't Wi-Fi. So it's another one of those terms that we like to use to confuse people. But it essentially uses unlicensed spectrum. So one of the challenges with just Wi-Fi in general is that there's only so many, you know, if you think about TV channels, there's so many channels out there. So what they're trying to do is use channels that aren't in use through other means in order to gain higher bandwidth. So
like broadcast spectrum, like radio and radio use.
Yes, exactly. So they're trying to figure out, and there's auctions for these for spectrum, and it's, you know, in the billions and billions of dollars where people will say, okay, I'm going to own this frequency range or this spectrum. And there's new technologies now that are trying to come up with ways to leverage this more kind of locally. How can I use it not to broadcast, say, you know, out for 1,000 miles, but maybe I can use that for my house and I use something that's unlicensed that no one has rights to use, and I can leverage that to speed up my internet.
Will this take off, you think?
It'll take a little while to adopt.
Yeah.
I mean, we have so many devices out there right now, so many home routers, so many routers in coffee shops and in businesses that are using the current technology. Just like any time we have a shift in spectrum like this, it'll take a while. For example, a lot of hotels that you stay at, some of them are still running like what we call 802.11a or b devices, which is a slightly slower version of Wi-Fi as opposed to the 802.11n that most modern routers use and most devices use. But since it's backwards compatible, you know, a lot of people just notice that, hey, my Wi-Fi here is slower.
Right.
And so that's probably the kind of adoption that we'll see with this when they bring out, I think it's 802.11af and 802.22, I think is the actual technical term. If I geek out, let me push up my glasses.
Right.
So, you know, as those become available, we'll see more adoption of it. And it'll take time.
Yeah, and what they're trying to do is the article makes reference to if you can get a TV signal, you can get internet. I mean, it's a huge challenge when
you start
looking at
rural. So if you're out in the mountains of Montana, you can't get internet probably, but maybe
right.
you can.
Right, that's what they're trying to do. And right now you can get internet through satellite, but it's incredibly expensive and it's incredibly slow.
I'm talking dial-up speeds
right.
in many instances.
Yeah, dial-up speeds
in many
instances.
If you remember dial-up speeds.
I've heard of it.
From yesterday. Year. So they're trying to say, okay, how can we get high-speed internet out to people, you know, that are too far because a lot of the current technology has some distance limits.
Okay, well, let's take our take a look at security. Let's turn our attention to some recent incidences of passwords and the things that we rely on to sort of keep our data safe and keep our identity safe. Not holding up. I understand that there's at least some reporting out this week that says passwords are weaker than they've ever been before. Right?
Yeah, and we've touched a little bit on this before, but I think it's never something that you can just leave completely off the table when you're talking technology. I think it's good for us to revisit this topic every now and then because maybe this is the time where at least one person will be like, maybe I shouldn't use the same password for everything. And as long as that happens, I'm happy. But yeah, new data is out showing that passwords are less secure than they've ever been. In fact, it's really interesting. A desktop computer that you can buy out of Best Buy, just any Dell machine that's got a Intel Core i7 processor, which is, you know, the current generation processor. If they just set to have a brute force password attack, they say that currently a 5-digit password can be hacked just in a matter of hours. But if you increase that to a 6-digit password, it can take a day and several hours. A 7-digit password could be more than 10 days. So just the length of password is very important, especially when we're talking about the fact that there's software on the market right now that you, Brian, could go and download and within a day have this piece of software on your desktop machine hack a password.
Yeah, it's very easy.
So it's now the challenge has been, you know, to kind of make a better mousetrap. But now I can go to any computer store and just buy a normal computer, nothing fancy, and hack into the accounts. And essentially the way it works is just keep on keep it on. So it just tries one, nope, it didn't work, try it again. And so if there's not the proper security precautions in place where they say, hey, someone had 27 failed attempts in a row, we should probably lock that account, then it's a good chance that, companies can get hacked. Just purely over time, you try it enough times that ultimately you're going to get it right.
Yeah, and if you want to visualize it, just think about when you watch a spy movie and the guy sits down, plugs his computer into the network, and you see all the letters flying across everywhere. I mean, that's basically what it's doing.
Just trial and error.
Trial and error.
Yeah.
I want to invite our listeners into the conversation. If you have questions about internet access or security, tech issues that you've been hearing about, talk to our tech experts. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at updatedate@kcur.org. And, of course, on this show, we want to remind you we're at Twitter. We're on Twitter, at KCUR UpToDate. And, of course, you can always post to our Facebook page, our KCUR Facebook page as well, with your questions or comments. Well, before we leave the subject of passwords, remind us, what should we do with our passwords? What's the key to a safe, secure password?
Something that's easy to remember and long.
Okay, the longer the better.
Yeah, and anymore, there's a lot of challenges with so many passwords, right? I mean, the typical user has maybe a few hundred passwords. So to try and come up with a way that works for you, you know, there's a lot of online tools that help facilitate that, that do it securely. But you have to come up with a way that's convenient. If you just keep, you know, a post-it note stuck to your monitor, that's ultimately opening up another way of security, which is kind of physical access to that. So, you know, there's all kinds of ways to do it. But the key thing is to make it easy for you to access that, whatever it is, in a secure manner.
And Justin, you said we shouldn't have the same password on everything. How many, yeah. What should I have not have the same password on? What things should I separate?
Gosh, all of the things. I think would be a good,
so I have to
separate
have
all of the things.
Passwords.
Yeah, I think it's important to have a very secure password on, say, your email, because if someone is trying to hack into, say, your Facebook account, if you have an email that comes into your email account saying, hey, by the way, someone's trying to access your Facebook account, but if that's the password that they have, then they can get that email and reset it. So I think it's important to have a strong password on your email account, your Facebook account, your banking account. Definitely. If you bank online, you should not use the same password that you use for anything else for your banking information. And you should make that as complicated and as long as you possibly can. There are some excellent tools also that people can use. One that I use is called 1Password. It's multi-platform, Windows, PC, iOS, Android. And it'll help you generate a password. It will remember that password for you. It stores that password locally on your machine, so it's not throwing it up into the cloud where it can be hacked or anything. And then if you remember your master password, it can automatically fill in passwords that it's generated for you onto certain websites or certain applications. So using something like that, if you have a hard time remembering passwords, I'd highly recommend getting a password management software program, one that is locally stored on the machine, not put up into a cloud.
Yeah, and there's one other thing I would add to that, which has come about recently, is you know, multi-device authentication or two-factor identification, so that if someone does try to access, say, your Facebook account from a new computer, then it'll be like, hey, are you sure? Maybe you need to, you know, your mother's maiden name kind of thing, right? So it's, right, it's not just, hey, just log in from any random computer, any random device, anywhere, but make sure that it's a device you've accessed that from before, or prompt you for additional information.
And don't tell people your mother's maiden name.
Right, right. And there are a lot of different security tools that you can utilize in websites like Facebook and Twitter. So, for example, I have something set up where if I log on to Facebook from a new device for the first time, I get an email saying, hey, Justin, did you access Facebook from this particular IP address? If so, cool, ignore this. If not, then you might want to be concerned. And a lot of things have that service. I know Apple, for example, on Apple IDs, if you make an iTunes purchase from a new device, they'll send you an email saying, hey, did you just use iTunes on an iPad? Because if not, you might want to be concerned. So if you have the option of getting those emails, I would opt in for them. Sometimes it can be annoying.
Yeah.
Say you're restoring an iPad and you're getting that email constantly, but it's better to be slightly annoyed than potentially compromised.
Well, and Google, I use that for Google, so that if I try and, you know, add my Google Calendar to a new device or whatever, then I get those notifications. And the nice thing is, you know, now you can use Facebook and Google and Twitter or whatever to sign into all these other services. But the challenge is, the negative negative consequence of that is that if someone hacks that, then all of a sudden they have access to everything.
Let's take a call at 816-235-2888. That's the number to call with your questions or comments for our techsperts. 235-2888. Jim from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. You were talking about a list of millions of UDID numbers that the FBI gathered, and I was wondering, how did they get those numbers, and what privacy implications would that have?
Well, we touched on that a little bit, but as far as what privacy implications there would be, it's kind of right now the FBI has that information kind of centralized. What the hackers have released is mostly just the UDIDs themselves and maybe the name of the device that that ID is associated with. So really the only way someone will get your name out of this release is if the name of your iPhone is, you know, Jim's iPhone. Then they could get that information associated with the UDID as opposed to, say, Jim's iPhone, and this is his first and last name and home address, and this is everywhere he's ever surfed. So they haven't released a lot of that. The hackers haven't. As far as what the FBI is doing with that information, good question for the FBI.
Yeah, well, and I maybe I missed it too. Jim asked how they got the numbers. Do we know that exactly?
No,
they're
the
FBI.
Say.
They probably will not tell you.
But it wasn't a subpoena sort of situation.
Not as far as we know. Scale. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And at one time that was information that anybody could obtain access to. But since then, you know, there are a lot of challenges where you say your phone book was being uploaded to some random website somewhere and maybe even overseas. So there are a lot of challenges with that. So kind of they came out and said, okay, no more playing nice guy and let's stop that immediately.
Jim, thanks for the call. So we've talked, you mentioned the cloud a moment ago as the place where you don't want to just store all your passwords out there where they might be accessible. We've talked before about having data float around on the internet. It sounds like there's still a bit of confusion, though, about what cloud computing is.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's actually a study that just came out recently. It was a very large study, and it came back saying that over 50% of Americans don't really have a strong grasp of what cloud computing is. In fact, many of them believed that much like their satellite service for their television, bad weather or inclement weather could adversely affect cloud services. Now, while this to a certain
extent,
there is a slight truth to this. For example, a power outage at a data center caused by weather could affect your cloud services.
And
it did
for Amazon.
Exactly. But that's not what the survey is talking about. The survey is talking about like a thunderstorm rolling through town.
Like the cloud is blocking.
Like the cloud is somehow blocking. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So and that's not quite the way that it works. So
51% of Americans.
Yeah, yeah, a fairly large percent. And there's some really interesting numbers here. So like according to this study, 54% of Americans claim that they never have used cloud computing, although many of them do because from the same survey, 65% banked online, 63% shop online, 58% use social networking like Facebook or Twitter, 45% have played online video games, 29% store photos online. And that's not just share, but store them. 22% store music or videos online, so things that they've bought through iTunes, Amazon, or Google. And 19% use online file sharing. That's all cloud computing. So even though a lot of these folks said, over half said, yeah, I don't use the cloud, in fact, they are every single day. If you use iCloud to synchronize your contacts, if you use Google to synchronize your contacts, that's cloud computing.
Right. 816-235-2888. Don't forget you can email us at updatedate@kcur.org. We're raising all these questions about the security of our phones, of our iPads. There was a story out this week, though, that makes us wonder if maybe phones can be too secure, right, Dustin?
Right. So, you know, what's evolving here in mobile device universe is that, you know, people are losing their devices all the time. So, you know, right now, you know, the average kind of cycle is about every 2 years or so. By then, people have either broken their device to the point that they need a new one or new features have come out where they want to get a new one. So somewhere around 2 years, and some people hold on devices for, you know, 3, 4, maybe longer than that. But generally speaking, people replace about every 2 years. And what people very quickly realized is that if they did lose it, they wanted that information private. They didn't want it out floating around for those pictures that they took at that college party
right.
when they were freshmen or whatever. And there's been a lot of cases where people will lose their devices and then they'll dig up, you know, pictures or text messages, inappropriate content, needless to say. So what companies, cell phone companies, started doing is like, okay, we know that's a real challenge for people and we're not going to try and fix the psychology and everything else behind it, but let's at least make it easier for them to keep that information secure and private. Not that anyone, when they go to a cell phone store, actually look for that. That's not something that they ask for, but the manufacturers realize it's something they have to deal with. So what they did is they started creating more ways for consumers to protect their information easily. So, you know, previously when you installed software or whatever, there was no default password, or the password was just like default. Mm-hmm. Now companies, now when you create a new service or establish a relationship, require you to set up a
real password.
Right, because they know people are lazy and just don't do it. So what this is doing now is another way to help protect consumers from their own selves. And what it does is actually encrypting the information that's on your device, to the point where now it's making it a lot more difficult for people that are trying to help. Like people forget their password. Well, can't you just like super user in and fix it? And no, it's locked. So we can, but we're going to erase everything and start over, which is relatively easy for us to do, but relatively painful for consumers because they lose all their information.
Yeah.
And if that information isn't backed up, then it's gone. And what's interesting is a lot of devices now are actually the reason why this has become such a big issue, especially when we're looking at government and criminal investigations, is because the devices are so encrypted that it's actually causing problems for forensic scientists to recover information that they need to solve crimes off of these devices. So when, you know, the article that we were talking about said that iOS is too secure, it's because that encryption is so high that it's hard for even government agencies to crack it. The Department of Justice says that it's actually a hindrance in criminal investigations because they can't get into the device.
Really? And it's that good?
Yeah. So what's interesting is there's a back way into a lot of this. If you back up your phone physically to your computer, but you don't encrypt that backup, even though your phone is encrypted, you can get into that backup file and get information. So that's actually how criminal investigations are getting in.
They want to go get the actual laptop.
Exactly.
Of the
person. Now, there is a way to get around. If you just check encrypt a backup on iTunes, mm-hmm. then it will encrypt it, and then they're out of luck.
Yeah. And one of the ways that Apple is accommodating this and other vendors are doing something similar is that there's a certain ID that is not recorded anywhere. And basically what that's doing is guaranteeing that only that phone can talk to that storage device. So it's not like you can just crack open the phone and take that hard drive out and stick it somewhere else. That doesn't work, and that mm-hmm. doesn't work by design. And that's how historically the government was doing it. They'd find some criminal's phone, they'd crack it open, steal the parts out, and figure out, okay, this is the emails they sent, and you can't do that anymore. And even the simple things like on touchscreen devices, a lot of times you can see kind of fingerprints, like, okay, it has a 1, a 2, and a 3, and a 4 in it because that's where their keys are. You know,
dusting the just for fingerprints.
Yeah, just by holding it up.
Or even just holding it up to the light, looking at the glare,
But now there's a lot of devices now that have after 10 failed attempts, it can delete everything or can permanently lock it. So there's that too.
Real quick, an email. There's a lot of interest this morning in this password security question. Sean in Midtown writes, I appreciate the call for users to have stronger passwords, but one of the problems I face with many website logins is that they do not accept passwords with special characters or even capital letters. I guess he means they're not case sensitive. So some of the responsibility has to fall back on the providers to allow users to have strong password security.
That's very true. And some providers will actually not even encrypt that password. So you also have to consider, how does this place that I'm entering a password, and how do they store that password? Do they hash it? Is it stored in some sort of a database with my username?
If you don't use different passwords, now they've got your password for your bank account.
Exactly. You know, they can test that out. So it's important to figure out how that website is securing your password and your login information, and how they'll try and get you that information if you ever forget it.
One more security-related question from Tom in Lake City. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. What's your question?
Seeing a problem that's popping up now. I've seen it from 3 or 4 people we know, that somehow somebody gets into their address book and sends emails out to everybody in their address book, and usually it's an advertisement. The thing I've seen is just an advertisement, you know, how to make money in your home.
But it looks like it's from you, right? That's the problem?
It looks like it's from somebody I know.
Right.
And it's just, you know, it has a subject line, and you got to see this, you know, or something like that. I'm on to it a little bit, but who's doing this and how does it get stopped?
Well, there's a lot of different groups that are doing that. It's one of the older tricks in the book, and primarily that's done when the user enters their email, username, and password into a website. A lot of times, if you're surfing the internet, you'll see a little pop-up window that says, "Your computer may be compromised. Buy this antivirus protection." And some less savvy users may enter in their information into that dialog box, and boom, now they can get into your email, now they can get your address book. So it comes back to password security. If someone sends you an email like that, send the user an email directly and say, "Hey, you might want to change your password." And that should eliminate it.
Tom, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Coming up after the break, we're going to spend more time here with our tech experts, talk a little bit about advertising as it continues to progress its way through Twitter and Facebook, some new innovations in the works. We'll also talk about the rumors and facts, if we actually know any, about the iPhone 5 alleged to come out in the next few weeks. Plus, make way for squishy camouflaged robots. Yes, squishy camouflaged robots coming up on Up to Date after the break. Also, don't forget to call us with your questions, 816-235-2888. Justin Parlett and Dustin Jacobson, the tech experts, would love to hear what's on your mind. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's conversation with the Religion Roundtable about weddings across various traditions, you can find that and all our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. And don't forget to join us tomorrow as we examine disparities in healthcare quality and accessibility facing lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in Missouri. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. Today we're talking with the tech experts, Justin Parlett of UMKC and Dustin Jacobson of Flat Square Technology Group. They're here every month to take your questions about technology and gadgets and all the latest news from around the internet about the internet. Call us at 816-235-2888, 235-2888 with your questions, or of course email us at uptodate at kcur.org. One last question about security, and it involves security of a very famous Apple computer user, Steve Jobs. Had some iPads stolen after his death, right?
Yeah, the house that he and his family lived in, and I guess the family still lives there, even though the wife's bought a brand new, like, huge multi-million-dollar spread somewhere else.
But anyway,
they're renovating that house, and someone just basically hopped the fence, got into the garage, found a spare key, went in there, stole a bunch of stuff, including some iPads, iMacs, iPhones, the guy's wallet, and then started using the devices kind of foolishly.
Right. That's not so hard to track, right?
Yeah, no, especially since these are all corporate devices that were probably tied very closely with Apple servers. They phoned home very quickly, and the gentleman was caught pronto. Which was kind of a fun little security. That's probably not going to happen if someone takes my iPad. It's not going to get tracked that quickly. But yeah, it's one of those situations where it kind of brings home security, and the security of your devices.
Yeah, and they discovered it within a few hours. So basically, the equipment got stolen. And the thief took it and went online. It's like, all right, let's see what's, you know, how this works.
Now, is this where the UDIDs come in? Is that what helped track it?
Actually, yeah. On this, it was the MAC address and the IP address. Because these were set to basically use Apple's internet connection, they basically tunneled in, much like many people do for work, through VPNs. It was very easy for Apple to track that because they have a static IP address. So your IP address normally changes depending on which internet connection you're on. But if your device is set to have a static address on the network, then it's going to have that same address every time. So it was very easy for these to kind of be tracked as opposed to, say, you know, Dustin's iPad or my iPad because the IP address would constantly be changing with internet connections.
Yeah, and there's some other kind of interesting things here is that they noticed – so basically whenever you connect to the internet, you're assigned an IP address, which may be temporary, may be long-term, but depending upon where you're connecting from. But basically what they saw was that there are other devices connected to that same – if you think about it, the same phone number. So they're calling from the same phone number. And they're able to then say, okay, this one has an iTunes account and then therefore has names and all that other stuff. So they very quickly figured out who this real person was with very minimal information.
So if you're going to steal Steve Jobs' iPad, you should not go to your own home right. and start logging in from home.
And what's really funny is he stole so much stuff that he started selling it to friends and giving it to friends. And the police department actually used his Facebook page to figure out who his friends were and where this had come down to. And what was really crazy about all of this is the guy claims he doesn't know it was Jobs' house, and he didn't know it was Jobs' stuff until he got home and started looking through the wallet and saw that he had Steve Jobs' driver's license.
Yeah.
He was like, oh,
too late to put it back.
Yeah, it's like I can't really go back. Fenced a lot of jewelry. It was just really kind of one of those situations where it was weird. He claims he did it because he was really poor, and yet at home he had a high-speed internet connection and – it's just a very strange, bizarre case,
yeah.
And definitely one of those fun World's Dumbest Criminals kind of situations if you enjoy that sort of thing.
816-235-2888 is the number to call with your questions about technology and gadgets. We haven't talked yet about social media today, and I want to check in with Twitter and Facebook, which are making a couple of changes, including how they handle advertising, right, Dustin?
Yeah, so Twitter has made several changes over the last years. Some more friendly developers and some not so friendly developers. So a lot of these social media platforms really grow by other companies. Sometimes they make money, sometimes they don't, but they leverage that platform to build things on top of it. So if you think about, say Foursquare, people checking in on their phone saying, hey, I'm at Starbucks. Well, that's great if it lives within just Foursquare, but it can't really grow. It's kind of limited. But if all of a sudden people can then take that and share it out to Twitter or share that out to Facebook, then all of a sudden it can grow much quicker because people say, oh, they're at Starbucks. How's that work? What are they doing there to get there? So what Twitter has done here more recently is they're trying to figure out how they can make money. Facebook being public, they're under the same challenge. How can they make more money? So what they're trying to do now is enforce their ads across all these other apps that are out there. So people leverage what's called the API so that they can take the core functionality of Twitter and make other things out of it. And now Twitter's coming out and saying, well, that's great, but we need to make money off of that. So we've got to figure out a way that we can monetize that, which is through ads. So they're saying that's great that you may have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars building this whole platform and service and everything, but now we're changing the rules of the game, and we can because we own the system to do
so,
that.
So what practically does this look like for me? Does it mean that in my Twitter feed I'm going to see more promoted
right.
tweets?
So if you go, say, onto Twitter.com, you'll see there's recommended to follow and there's global trends. And some of these advertising services are fairly expensive to do. But that is only on the web interface.
So if I'm using TweetDeck or Hootsuite
exactly.
or something.
So like if you're using TweetDeck or something else, you'll see there's no ads. Well, there's obviously Twitter still has to pay for all that back end kind of stuff. And like, hey, wait a second. How can we make money off of that? Well, we can stick ads in there. So that's kind of what Twitter is doing. And you'll also see now with Facebook, up until here very recently, there was no ads on the mobile device. And the reason this is such a big deal is that about 50% of social media engagement happens through mobile devices, whether it's a phone or a tablet or whatever, it's mobile. So 50% roughly. So none of that had ads. So right there, they're like, okay, we've got to figure that out and fast. So one of the ways that Facebook did it is now you'll see ads in your stream. If you pull up, say, use a Facebook app on your phone, you'll see ads in there.
And I have to think this is something that users are not going to be big fans of.
As long as it's not horribly obtrusive, users are fairly indifferent to it for the most part. Once it becomes an eyesore, once it becomes something that's taking over feeds and hindering the experience, then you'll probably see people start to backlash a little bit more. And I'm not talking about the typical Facebook changed the banner system and I'm furious kind of posts that you always see. You know, I don't want timeline. It's awful. That kind of moaning that you typically run into. You'll probably see
I've
a lot
never
more.
Done anything like that.
No, I embrace timeline. I think it's a great thing. The big problem with timeline is that, you know, time does not flow in a linear progression. It's all wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff.
Yeah.
So these advertisements that will come through my Twitter feed or through the Facebook news feed, these are targeted at me, right?
Right. And that's one of the other changes here with Facebook is that historically, with Twitter, it was pretty well anonymous. But now they can access more information about you, and they can do interest-based targeting. For Twitter. Now, Facebook has been able to do that for a while, and Facebook is actually kicking up one notch farther, which is going to raise some real kind of privacy issues. And what Facebook, at least last I looked, they haven't officially rolled this out, but they've been testing it, which is the ability to target specific individuals, which is something that Facebook has prohibited really up until this point. You could target people that, you know, liked coffee or that lived in, you know, Kansas City or a zip code or whatever, but you couldn't target Justin or you couldn't target Brian or Steven or whoever. You could target them if you knew kind of the age and gender and all those different things, but you couldn't target individuals. And now Facebook is rumored to be allowing companies to do that, where they could actually upload either a phone number or an email address to then target those specific people. Now, the business use of that is more of a like a customer relationship management system or a CRM system.
Ah, so you target their own customers.
So that they can target their own customers. So say they've got a sale going on in their store today, and instead of sending them an email or a text message or a print ad or whatever, they can target them right on Facebook. Say, hey, you know, there's a sale today at the, you know, Overland Park, whatever, and please come in the next 24 hours. So they're actually targeting or in theory allowing you to target individuals.
Could they actually tweet to like my public Twitter feed, hey, Brian, how do you like that yellow hat you bought last week? I mean, is that potentially what we're looking at?
I mean, eventually, I think on a long enough timeline, you're looking at that. And I already get a little bit of that now sometimes. I just stayed at a hotel over the weekend and got a message asking about how my trip was in my email.
But that was privately directed to you.
Right. And so we're going
– I could see lots of problems if it says, hey, how'd you enjoy your stay in the Hilton exactly. Orlando? What? You were in Orlando,
what?
Honey?
Yeah.
Right.
No, okay. And I think that could definitely be – because one of the things that they asked for when I signed up for their rewards program was my Twitter handle. So, you know, we see companies gathering this information, and I think as it becomes more standard, we'll start seeing those kinds of interactions. And savvy businesses are already doing that to a certain degree. If you tweet about a brand, you don't even have to use the Twitter handle for that brand. Oftentimes, you'll get a response back from an agent who's looking for keywords, and they'll say, hey, you know, what didn't you like about your experience with so-and-so?
Right.
So, I mean, to a certain degree, we're seeing some of that now, but the automated process that you're talking about, I think is something that will be coming. I'd be shocked if it didn't.
And it's a little different because Twitter is public. So I'm kind of most, you know, 90% or so of the accounts are public, meaning that when I say something on Twitter, everybody can see it.
Right.
On Facebook, generally speaking, most information is private.
Just your friends.
To just your Facebook friends. And there's a whole bunch of different security
preferences. Not very private.
Really. Right, right. Yes, it's still, but if your friends have friends and they can maybe see it, there's lots of challenging things there. But generally speaking, it's more kind of closed where Twitter is open.
It's a good chance to remind you that you can follow us at our Twitter handle, at KCUR UpToDate. You can also follow or like the KCUR Facebook page. We have talked on and off here throughout the hour about iPhones, but the big news in the iPhone world is that, and has been the big news for years, is that there's a new iPhone coming out. But now we actually have a date, right, Justin?
Well,
we have a tentative.
No,
we can speculate on it.
I want to preface all of this conversation by saying it is pure speculation.
Right. Everything we're about to say is rumors.
You should not make any plans based on this. Don't call your friends up and say, "Guess what I heard on the Techsperts." Other than it's speculation.
All right.
So rumor has
speculate
it.
Away.
All right, here it is. Rumor has it on the 12th, Apple has their big announcement that the new iPhone will be coming, and then they're going to launch it on the 21st.
And they get this information by like checking the theater where they usually make announcements.
Right. The Moscone Center where they normally have these announcements. Now here's the deal: that center's actually already booked on the 12th by a different company, so they might. be doing the announcement at a different center. The last time Apple did an announcement for the new iPad, they actually did it on the Apple campus. And they typically will only do that if they're launching one product. Just looking, you know, at the pattern. If they're launching more than one product, then they try to get a bigger stage. So we're probably going to see the launch of a new iPhone. Designs of it are leaking out all over the internet. People are claiming that they've stolen these parts from Foxconn plants, or you know, they're sending out mock builds to case manufacturers so they can know what kind of case they need to build. And it's a slightly larger format. And
larger
new
how?
Device. Well, it's about a 4-inch screen. It's a little
so
bit. It's a little bit taller.
Longer.
A little bit taller.
Okay.
About the same thickness, maybe just a tiny bit thinner.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the. But
main we're thing speculating.
Right now. Yes. We're speculating. This is all based on things that we've seen online. Now, I will say this: a lot of these rumors that are popping up now come from the same location that had very accurate information when the iPhone was redesigned for the iPhone 4. Because if you'll remember, the iPhone 3GS and the iPhone 4 had a substantially different design aesthetic, and the iPhone 4 and 4S were pretty much the same. Just a few modifications.
4 inches longer. That seems like
a total of 4 inches.
Oh.
So it's a 4-inch screen now instead of like a 3.5.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's just a little bit taller.
Be an
not
oddly
4
shaped
inches
smartphone.
Longer.
Yeah. Hard to get it in your
then
pocket.
We've got one of those big Samsung tablet phones that look really weird when people pull them out in public.
Right.
They're like, you're talking into a tablet? And they're like, no, yeah. This is my phone.
Right.
Well, and one of the things that I'll just – there's since there is so much speculation out there is that now because it is such a big deal, I mean people are looking at schedules, reservations for conference centers. You know, one of the things that leaked out was Verizon supposedly had blocked out a window September 21st to the end of the month about vacations. They said, can't take vacation. And really now that means that the iPhone's going to be released?
Well, I do recall on previous iPhone releases back in the day when it was just AT&T and Apple reading on rumor sites, hey, Apple's blacked out vacation dates for employees during this two-week period. That means so that particular
there
piece
is a historical
of speculation,
context.
Yeah, that's been going on for a while.
Okay, so
but Verizon's where they get it now.
Other than the screen size, anything rumored to be different about the about this phone quickly?
All new guts. It's going to have a faster processor. It's going to have iOS 6, which is going to be more advanced than what's on the market now. They're talking about redesigned headphones. One thing that I think is really interesting and troublesome and I don't like, if I may be cranky for a minute, is they've apparently moved the headphone port to the bottom of the device, kind of like on the iPod Nano, which I frankly think is dumb, mostly because people wrap their cords around their headphone or around the phone that way, and it causes a lot of stress on the headphone connector, and that can lead to damage to the device. Yeah, it means me, in my daily job, more maintenance and more work. And so, in other words, if you're listening and the iPhone port is indeed on the bottom, please don't wrap your headphones around it.
Yeah, but there, I mean, it's longer battery life, bigger screen, higher speed with 4G support. Those are kind of the key takeaways.
Yeah, 4G, something a lot of folks are.
Oh, and a new dock connector. They're saying that it's got a redesigned dock. So we've had this 30-pin connector going back to almost the original. Yeah, going back to the original iPod.
Yeah.
They've pretty much had the same form factor for ages now, a decade. And they're talking about now, for the first time, they've redesigned that dock connector, which means that you're going to have to buy adapters for any of your current dock devices to work with a new phone.
So all new accessories, car chargers, Bose, sound system,
of course.
Everything.
Or probably a $30 adapter.
Yeah.
So I am on record as hating to type on my iPhone. I hate it. I the one thing I miss about my Palm Pre, well, actually I miss a lot of things about it, but was the keyboard. No rumors of a new keyboard on the iPhone 5, but there is some talk out of Nokia about the keyboard.
Yeah,
right?
And there's kind of like no anymore. There's no touchpads. Everything now is touch screen. Everything is lacking a keypad. But Nokia actually came out. Now they have a joint stake in this being successful. But they did a poll, and actually people prefer to have some kind of a keypad in order to interface with the mobile device. Roughly about 50% or about half the people actually preferred a real keypad. But there are, there are advantages and disadvantages of
now,
that.
I want to point out that this is a survey on Nokia's own website. They won't tell you how many people took the survey, and there's really no data behind it. And I kind of feel it's sort of like Dunkin' Donuts coming out saying people like to start their day with a donut. You know, yeah. it's
but I would say guys, that of course. I do know a lot of people that do prefer to have some kind of a keypad. So yeah. I can somewhat
I'm inclined to believe this
validate
as
that.
Well.
Yeah. So 50%, I'd believe that.
I think there's some acclimation that happens, and I think the learning curve for some folks might be steeper than others. I'll grant you that.
Right.
But in my experience, when I move people off of devices, I've had more folks later on come back and say, hey, I'm actually liking this more than I thought I would. The first month I had it, I hated it.
Yeah.
But now I'm pretty happy.
I'm pretty sure Justin just called me old. I think that's pretty much what I heard.
Because I've got users younger than us that have come back on this one.
Hey, one more question here from Suzanne, who writes us by email. Any comments on the new Kindle to be released? Do we know a date that it will be available? Do you guys know anything about the new Kindle?
I have not seen a date. It's
usually been
well.
In time for Christmas.
Yeah, if it comes out, it'll be in time. I'm guessing for the holidays
for Christmas delivery with Amazon Prime.
Right,
right. So we had hoped today to get to your top five cool gadgets for $50 or less. We will do that next time, but we will certainly let's take one or two of those and tease our listeners a bit. What's one of your top five cool gadgets for $50 or less in 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, there's mine is it's a solar charger for USB devices. You know, we all have had that problem. We're out in the middle of, you know, wherever, running errands, and you know, our phone runs out of battery. So I've got a bunch of these little battery packs made by Energizer. There's a bunch of companies that make them. But this one is actually solar. So essentially how it works is it's out there, it's in the sunlight, and it'll recharge the battery that ultimately will charge back your cell phone.
How much does that cost?
They're anywhere from $25 to $50.
Okay, I might order one of those. Do you have a real a cool gadget you want to commend to us today, Justin?
I got this really neat watch online not too long ago, and it's analog, and it's marvelous. It is the least techie thing I've bought in ages, and I'm so happy with it.
So who's old now? That's
me.
My question.
I am.
That's Justin Parlett. He's a support system administrator for UMKC. Dustin Jacobson is chief strategy officer at Flat Square Technology Group. Together, they are our techsperts. If you want to know more about them or get more information about our show, you can go to kcur.org. Thanks, guys, for being here today.
A pleasure. Again.
Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow, the health disparities faced by Missouri's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender population. The senior producer of Up to Date is Steven Steigman. One last note, Steve Kraske is in Charlotte, North Carolina all week covering the Democratic Convention. Don't forget, you can hear special coverage of the convention from NPR News tonight through Thursday, beginning at 7 p.m. right here on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are Up to Date.